Chapter 4. Sweetheart, are you okay? Don't take any stupid risks. You're not responsible for saving the Galactic Alliance single-handed. Shula Shevu, newly married, in an encrypted message to her husband. Bastion, Imperial Remnant, Moff Assembly Hall at Ravelin. It was always sobering to be a spectator at your own funeral. Pelion stood at the window overlooking the parade ground and watched the ornate cannon carriage that would carry his remains. Like him, it was a survivor from a different age, archaic in design, but still able to fulfill its function in war. The paired blood fins drawing it came to a halt at precisely the center of the paved expanse, remained motionless for a count of 10, and then wheeled right to follow a perfectly straight line through the archway and out into the streets of the capital, the brilliant scarlet crests that earned them the name bobbing like flames in the morning sunlight. Pelion was sure they were a subspecies of gonoidal certeses, but they had that striking red crest like the marine predator, and blood fin was much easier to pronounce. A token platoon of Imperial Guards marched behind in their everyday number 5 uniforms, not parade best. However many times Pelion saw the rehearsal, it was impressive. Bloodfins were notoriously hard to train in the art of dressage or precise cavalry displays. He made a mental note to congratulate the ceremonial staff. The carnivorous quadrupeds were formidable mounts, quite capable of fighting on their own even when their rider was dead, and they were not known for their obedience off the battlefield. Bastion had to rehearse the state funeral regularly because such magnificent displays of pomp and precision didn't happen overnight. A leader might die at any time, and Bastion liked to be prepared. Pelion sipped his calf, aware of the hum of conversation at his back, and watched the carriage and the guard platoon vanish into Ravelin's early morning quiet.
"Doesn't that depress you, sir?" asked Rige.
"Only if I'm taking part."
Pelion held out the translucent cup for a refill.
"I'll worry when I see hundreds of guards in their parade best."
He watched the reflection of the room behind him in the transparent-steel sheet of the window, and noted each Moff's arrival and whom he huddled with to chat before the meeting started.
2 minutes, Vitor, and then we begin."
It was a regular weekly assembly of the Moff Council of the Empire, nothing extraordinary or unscheduled, but in the last 24 hours, Pelion had been made aware of activity on the informal diplomatic front. He could still rely on Moff Soretti to keep him up to speed on backroom politics, even though the man was retired. All those Moffs, and so very little empire to play in. It was bound to make them restless. Pelion glanced around the table during the meeting, playing the game of working out which of the Moffs wanted to assassinate him, and which saw some advantage in keeping him alive. Luckily, the only ones who were competent to take him on were also the most militarily able, and so were his allies. Nature had her checks and balances. They broke for Calf.
"All you need is patience, gentlemen. I'm 92, just sit it out."
"Admiral, may I refill your cup?"
Lesserson was one of the old-school Moffs, a man who believed in duty. He even kept himself combat fit and clipped his hair extra short to a suede-like bloom across his skull.
"I think this meeting is going to last a little longer than usual."
Pelion sipped thoughtfully.
"Did I ever tell you I was psychic?"
"I believe not."
"Oh, I am. I believe a great opportunity is going to come our way, one that will change our destiny."
Lesserson stifled a smile.
It's very general, sir.
I'll go out on a limb. I predict that at least one of our colleagues here has heard of a wondrous potential connected to the ongoing nastiness between the Galactic Alliance and the Confederation.
Lesserson allowed the full grin to take over his face, and cast a cautious eye over the cluster of men who treated Grand Moff Keel as a center of gravity.
I must remember to ask you to advise me when placing Udupiendo racing bets.
Pelion didn't know Jason Solo as well as he would have liked, but one thing he did know was that the man was both manipulative and impatient, a combination that meant he tended to start playing his games early. It was only a matter of time before the rebuff of his offer to talk about joining the Galactic Alliance camp was countered with a discreet word to the Moffs about what luscious opportunities their senile leader had passed up without telling them. In fact, if Jason didn't do it, Pelion would lose his faith in the enduring power of self-interest, which had kept the galaxy turning about its core since the planets had cooled enough to support bacteria. Where Neothel stood in this, he wasn't yet sure, but he knew her well enough to judge that her failing was her inability to stop Jason, not her active sanction of Jason's excesses as Joint Chief of State.
"Admiral, something significant has come to our attention,"
Keel said.
"I wonder if we might discuss it in the wider context of the war."
"The Empire has managed to stay out of the conflict so far,"
said Pelion.
"Thank goodness for that, Jason Solo. Faith is restored, and the galactic disk still turns.
What do you mean by context?"
"Threats and opportunities, Admiral. The war is sucking in more worlds, and the Jedi Council has upped sticks and moved out of Coruscant, which is a worrying development. It suggests more fragmentation in existing alliances, and that might make our neighboring sectors unstable. But it might also give us an opportunity to expand our sphere of influence."
Pelion took a spoonful of Gen honey and held it above his cup, letting a long ribbon of the viscous amber run off the spoon into the calf, then twirled it with a practiced wrist while he waited for Keel to go on. It wasn't the first time he'd used the silent routine on a meeting of the Moffs. They never seemed able to resist it, though, and by the time his spoon emerged shining and clean from the calf, they were getting uncomfortable and looking to Keel to fill the long gap.
"Do go on," said Lesserson.
"Our diplomatic sources say that the GA is recruiting allies from outside its usual sphere of influence," said Keel. "When the war is over, the map of the galaxy will look very different."
Lesserson smiled. It always made him look more disturbing than when he frowned.
"Well, there's a big gap near Corellia where Centerpoint used to be, for a start."
There was a ripple of laughter. Keel pressed on.
"Rewards may be there for the taking, gentlemen."
"In exchange for fighting Jason Solo's war for him?" said Rosset. "Is there anything we want badly enough for that?"
The discussion began rambling over the possibilities in a tapestry of voices.
"Neothel's war, too."
"Oh, let's not forget the Admiral, shall we?"
"If an Admiral was running it, it would be over by now. Solo could always lose the war, of course. If the GA is thinking this way, then perhaps the Confederation is, too. And maybe they've got a better offer."
"Is there an offer?"
The silence was sudden. It was an excellent question. Pelion thought it was time to remind them that he was not senile, that he was not a figurehead, and that he did not lack informants.
"Bilbringi and Borlias, if we commit troops and ships to the GA."
Pelion let the names sink in. He still enjoyed that silent moment of revelation he could create in a meeting. Yes, it was vulgar theater to reveal what he knew of the offer leaked to the Moffs in that way, but it was also a shot across the bows of any Moff who thought he could best the old man.
And of course my question would be, what's in it for us? Both those worlds are in the GA's gift to give, but there's still a small population in both systems, and we still might have to fight to take them. If it's the latter, then all the GA is doing is turning a blind eye to any expansion on our part, in exchange for our blood. And that seems to me like paying twice. If we wanted to expand, Solo would be in no position to stop us anyway, while he's so thinly stretched in this war. And we would need to commit nothing to his land-grab expeditions.
Then the question is whether we want to expand the Empire, Lesserson said. Do we? I would be inclined to wait and see what's left of the galaxy before we decide what we want, said Rosset. It might be the difference between snapping up a bargain at a sale and taking on a charity case that saps our resources.
Pelion felt the surge of old emotions again. This was about duty. Wars left the galaxy in tatters, and the galaxy's wounds were freshly healed after the Yuuzhan Vong War. It would take very little to tear the new tissue apart and make healing harder next time. Some worlds had recovered very little in a decade. This was the situation an empire could avoid, could stabilize, could heal. But if it meant working with the likes of Jason Solo, no, Pelion could never see that lasting. He might do business with Neothel, but not anyone as volatile and mystic as Solo.
We are the Empire. We bring order and justice for the common good.
The irony wasn't lost on him. This was clearly Jason Solo's ideology, too.
My problem with Solo,
Pelion said carefully, knowing that his exact words would reach Jason sooner or later, and wondering if it was worth the effort to track the route,
is that he has no background in government or the military. Jedi are very good at being in opposition, being the conscience on the shoulder of leaders, and keeping them on their toes, or even playing peacekeeping shock troops when needed. But they do not run things well. They're doers, not managers. Although I suspect Princess Leia has excellent leadership skills, sadly, she's not the one running the junta. How different life might be then.
Solo seems to be winning rather a lot, for a man whose first uniform was a colonel's, Keel said.
There's a Mon Cal admiral in a shiny white suit, to whom he owes at least some of that, I suspect.
Pelion realized Jason was not a textbook Jedi, and from the rumors he was hearing, probably dabbled in the dark side. But the principle stood. The Jedi Council was part think tank, part special forces, part mystical reassurance for the ruling class. Jedi could nudge and steer, and even block, but they were used to being a small weight added to tip the scales. Jason was from that tradition, but trying to be an emperor. He wasn't up to the task.
"Are we taking a vote on this?" asked Rosset.
"There's no formal offer, and so no motion on the table."
Lesserson drew the questions away from Pelion.
"I would simply suggest that we keep a watching brief on the situation, and if an opportunity arises to clarify what Chief of State Solo has in mind, then we look to Admiral Pelion to explore it if he so wishes. The Admiral has unique experience in seeing history repeat itself."
He had to hand it to Lesserson. The Moff had a superbly analytical mind, and didn't need to hear the gossip about Jason Solo's parallel course with his grandfather's to predict certain outcomes. Had Jason but known it, though, he was doing what every flawed and ideologically committed leader throughout history had done. His vision was all-consuming, and in time he would become so dazzled by it and so embedded in it that he would ignore and then simply not see the warning signs. There was always one more bold act, always one more final push that would vindicate him and make everything work. They all did it. The innovators and visionaries who had brilliant ideas and could get things moving had very different psyches to what was needed to reach and maintain stability. They simply looked for more glorious revolution to spark. It was hardwired. It was doomed to self-destruct. And it cost lives. Sooner or later, sooner probably, Jason Solo would overstretch himself, and then the battlefield would be open to those who could pick up the pieces and bring back quiet order. It would be left to the Empire. The Moffs filed out. Pelion hung back with Rige until the grand room was empty except for them and a housekeeping droid who hovered around clearing the splendid pleek table.
"I love it when you drop a full payload on them, sir," Rige said.
"That'll teach them to think I'm deaf. The Bloodfins aren't hauling me away yet."
But this was just the opening salvo. Jason Solo would not give up. Pelion wanted to see if anything of genuine substance was on the table before he made a more formal refusal. And he would not play by Jason's despotic rules. One Palpatine was enough for a lifetime. There was still calf left in the pot, and Pelion was in no hurry now. He chatted with Rige about the temperaments of pedigree bloodfins, and whether they could ever be safe for children to ride, given their propensity to devour whatever fell in front of them in the heat of the moment. He turned aside the droid when it attempted to clear away those tasty little Zirlia pastries. He felt clean and in control again. Then his comlink chirped. He recognized the incoming code.
"Excuse me, my boy," he said. "I must see what my Coruscant Bureau has to tell me."
It wasn't spying. Pelion was welcome to return to the capital any time as a respected veteran. He was simply keeping in touch with old friends. The message wasn't voice, but text, and it was very short. Rumors from impeccable sources said that Jason Solo had lost his temper after a skirmish and force-choked a junior officer to death in full view of the bridge crew.
"Oh, it's just like old times," said Pelion, finding that making light of enormities preserved his blood pressure for those times when he really needed to be angry. "We're all back in harness, reprising the glory days of our youth. Myself, Princess Leia and young Skywalker, Master Fett, and now little Lord Vader."
The military had adored Jason for throwing his lot in with them and looking after them. How long they might keep that up if he made a habit of killing underlings, Pelion wasn't sure. Jason still had a fund of goodwill to squander yet. No, Pelion would very definitely not be playing by Jason Solo's rules. Anakin Solo, Gandiel Fondor Hyperlane.
"Teb, no. She's gone."
It was the second time that morning that Darth Kytus had turned to Lieutenant Tebbutt for a sit-rep and remembered she was dead, which left him unsettled for reasons he had to stop and ponder. Captain Chevu gave him an odd glance when he turned to the station that Tebbutt had normally occupied on the bridge, but said nothing. Kaidus wandered across to the viewscreen to look out at distorted time and space, a respite while he grappled with his lapses. Tahiri, playing the part of a junior officer perfectly, stayed at her station with her hands clasped behind her back. Had he genuinely forgotten that he'd killed Tebbutt? Or was this all part of grieving? He'd lost count of the times he'd marked a passage in a holozine for his brother Anakin, or seen something funny that he just had to tell him, or any one of a dozen things that crashed painfully when he remembered in the next instant that Anakin was dead. Kaidus could remember how terrible that was, and yet he could flow walk back to Anakin's death and not suffer that again. He didn't understand why, and that bothered him. He was supposed to be past those petty personal concerns now. Perhaps this was the way it was for Sith of his status. Perhaps he needed the ability to switch off and do what was necessary, however distressing, and yet not lose the passions and sorrows that gave Sith strength. If he could take terrible decisions and never feel their enormity, then he would be no better than a droid. Flesh and blood needed the protective rule of someone who understood their pain. So he worked through things carefully, and he always found his answer. He was spared that for the time he needed the clarity to take hard decisions, and yet he still had to suffer the reality later, when it was safe to do so. If he forgot what pain and fear were, then he would also forget his duty to the trillions of beings who would look to him to stop their suffering. This uneasiness about Tebbutt was a price, then, not a failing, a reminder from the Force of what it meant to be flesh and blood, and whom he served. It made sense. He felt reassured.
"Dropping out of hyperspace in 5 standard minutes, sir," said the officer of the watch.
"Very good." Kaidus tore his gaze from the transparasteel and strode back to his bridge position. "So, Tahiri, we'll see Fondor shortly." She was in blue uniform, no badges of rank, and proper black fleet-issue boots, the ones with Durasteel-hardened toe-caps for safety. Tahiri hated shoes, but a warship was a dangerous place to go barefoot. It also looked sloppy and ill-disciplined.
"This is the next dissident planet we take back."
"Not today, though," she said. "We're doing reconnaissance."
A recce wasn't needed, given the intelligence Kaidus had on Fondor. Less than a standard year earlier, it had been a Galactic Alliance member state, and so its defensive capability and industrial output were a matter of record. Worlds didn't change into unknown quantities that fast. But Kaidus was still baffled by Fondor's decision to secede from the GA, an act he saw as inexplicably treacherous. The planet's yards had thrived on the custom of Coruscant-based regimes for decades, and this very hyperspace lane was testimony to the volume of hulls that had been transported from the orbitals here to the galactic capital.
"No," said Kaidus, "we're showing Fondor how easy it is to get at them. A speeder bus ride, practically."
"Don't they know that?"
"We often ignore the obvious. And this is partly education for you."
Tahiri's eyes flickered a little.
"In which discipline?"
"Decision-making."
The task of sweet-talking Pelion into listening to Kaidus's offer was something any intelligent, personable woman could do. But Kaidus needed Tahiri to be more than that. And he needed her to grow so that she wasn't performing like a circus rancor simply for tidbits of time spent flow-walking back to watch Anakin. The lure of his dead brother had been a legitimate way to get her interest, even if it was a tacky and rather cruel trick.
The weight of duty to the dark side meant that very few would embrace it head-on, without some self-gratification to hold them in its thrall while they learned the truth. It was a superficial means to a nobler end. Now he needed Tahiri to understand the gravity of Sith service, if she was to fill the gap left by Ben Skywalker as his apprentice. And as Ben had been blooded by the task of assassinating Durgedjan, so Tahiri needed to comprehend the gravity of her role, and move beyond romantic fantasies that could never happen. Anakin was dead, and he wasn't coming back. The kindest thing Kydus could do, would do one day soon, would be to force Tahiri to face up to that and live for the future.
"Okay,"
she said. Her lips moved uncertainly.
"I mean, very good, sir."
Tahiri obviously wanted to do well. Kydus watched the viewport, not the view fed from exterior cams to the monitors, as the slightly misshapen disk of Fondor resolved into a sharp-edged planet ringed by orbital shipyards like a swarm of tiny moons.
"Take us in as close as you can, Helm," he said.
"Very good, sir."
There was no hesitation, query, or even the hint in the Force of any doubt about his wisdom. The Star Destroyer moved from open space into the invisible but fiercely defended borders of Fondor sovereign territory. Kydus had neither rehearsed this nor warned the bridge crew. By now the early warning beacons had picked up the Anakin Solo's approach, and the ship's long-range sensors showed that Fondorian fighters were scrambling. Soon there would be a concerted attack on the ship, and he was counting on that. He wanted to test Tahiri's nerve and commitment.
"Weapons officer," he said, "when you acquire a target, do not fire. I repeat, do not fire. Shields and defensive systems, offline."
Nobody said a word, except Tahiri.
"Is this some special tactic?" she asked. "A feint?"
"No. I'm leaving the ship wide open to attack.
But
the weapons officer will give you firing solutions. You don't have to do any calculations. You only have to decide whether or not to open fire."
Kydus could see Shevu unclasp his hands from behind his back to fold his arms, but that was all. There wasn't the sense of nervousness around the bridge that might have been expected. The crew, as always, had faith in Kydus to deal with any situation. But Tahiri was rattled. She couldn't sense Kydus's intentions. He remained shut down in the Force as a matter of course now, emanating nothing to other Force users. And now she could see the flight of Fondorian assault fighters streaming out to intercept them. She had never had control of a warship.
"That's easy enough," she said, not sounding convinced.
He could feel her probing, groping around in the Force for hidden meaning, concealed traps.
"If someone's working out the firing solutions..."
"Are the fighters a threat to us, Tahiri?"
She was having doubts now. He'd sown uncertainty in her mind simply by asking an apparently obvious question.
"Possibly."
"How will you know?"
"When they power up their weapons."
"We have weapons online. Are we a threat to them, or just ready to deal with an attack? What are your rules of engagement? What if they don't fire?"
To her credit, Tahiri seemed to be thinking logically. The fighters were closing in. Bridge crew began shifting in their seats now, a little uneasy.
"Quickly, Tahiri. You only have seconds. A second is all it takes for a missile to penetrate the hull, vent a whole compartment, kill hundreds of our comrades.
Kytus knew the Fondorian pilots would detect charged, targeted, locked-on cannon, and yet no defenses. They'd think it was a trap. They'd hesitate, assess the target, wonder what they'd missed.
In range.
They've powered up but not acquired us, sir, said the weapons officer.
Tahiri.
Fire,
she said.
Take, take, take.
Cannon fire stabbed into the flight of fighters, streams of it taking out all six of them in sudden silent blooms of white light. Naval and air engagements were always impersonal, Kytus thought, machine on machine. Not at all like the urgency of facing an enemy in a trench or street and seeing a face. It took a while to sink in at first.
Reactivate defenses and lay in a course for Coruscant,
said Kytus. The Star Destroyer came alive with the lights and sounds of preparation for the hyperspace jump back to the core. Tahiri was still staring at the viewport.
Now, was that the right decision?
You tell me,
he said.
I neutralized the threat.
Or you fired on vessels that hadn't targeted you, and made widows and orphans for no good reason. Which do you think you did?
It's a war.
Wars have rules.
You told me to fire.
I told you that you could fire.
Kytus could see the crew trying to pretend the dissection wasn't taking place in front of them. They were all suddenly blind and deaf.
The decision was yours.
Is that what this is all for? You brought the ship here just for a few minutes, to see if I could give a command to fire?
Yes.
And put the ship at risk? And kill pilots?
It's what we do. How do you feel about that? Do you think about the living beings in those fighters? Or do you think about us in this ship? And can you ever be sure you took the only reasonable path open to you? I can't answer that. To become my apprentice, you have to be able to answer that in your own mind and live with the answer. You killed today. It should never feel easy or distant like some Holovid game. If it does, or it doesn't trouble you later at some time, then you're not up to the responsibility.
Tahiri stood silent and wide-eyed. She looked as if she was seriously considering the implications. Like him, she'd learned from her time among the Yuuzhan Vong. She knew that there was nothing like blood on your hands to make you grow up and understand all the things you had to sacrifice for duty. Kytus retired to his day cabin and sat reading the previous day's intelligence reports on the journey home. When he was still Jason Solo, Kytus had been warned that command, rule, was lonely. But now he knew what Tenel Ka had meant when she told him it was the price of being a leader. He was utterly alone now, rejected even by his daughter Alana.
That was my sacrifice.
He had convinced himself it was Mara Skywalker. Then he had convinced himself it was Ben's adulation he'd sacrificed by killing her. Now he knew that whatever the ancient Sith Tassels had prophesied in their arcane language of knots and colors, his sacrifice was an ordinary man's precious connection to other beings, love, trust, and intimacy.
He could never recover any of it. Alana was gone from him forever. His only comfort was that the galaxy would be safer for her. Lumia had said the cost would be high, but this was the price of order and justice. This was the price of stability, and his was just one life out of many, a price he considered worth paying however much it hurt. Tahiri would discover that, too, and she had just taken her first step on that path. A small gray area of right or wrong to most beings, but one that a Sith apprentice had to be able to handle.
This is duty.
There was a bleep at the cabin door. Shevu. Kytus felt the man coming down the passage, heralded by a sense of wariness and distaste in the Force. Shevu was a former police officer, a Coruscant Security Force man, and he brought his culture with him. He didn't like Kytus, and he didn't approve of his methods. That was as clear as day. But Kytus trusted him precisely because it was clear even to a non-Force sensitive. A man who didn't try to hide his feelings, but did the job well anyway, gave Kytus nothing to fear.
This is duty, too. Shevu understands what must be done.
Sir, shall I leave these reports on your desk, or would you prefer to discuss them?
Shevu said.
Leave them.
Whether the man liked him or not, there was nothing to be gained by alienating him further. He was very good at his job.
You look tired.
Sleepless nights, sir.
Shevu was being brutally honest. Kytus could sense that. A little anger, a little fear, something worrying him, a yearning to see someone he cared for. Distractions like that could become corrosive.
Problems?
Family stuff, sir.
You have a girlfriend, yes?
Not any longer, sir.
Ah.
Yes, Kytus understood abandonment by those who claimed to love and understand him.
I'm sorry. Isn't it time you had a few days off?
I haven't taken any leave, sir.
Burning out isn't being a good officer, Shevu. I need you sharp. Take 72 hours and come back refreshed. I can't do anything about the lady, other than say that I understand the toll that duty takes on relationships.
Shevu's surprise was palpable.
Thank you, sir.
His mood felt as if it had lifted a little.
Most generous.
Kytus watched the doors close behind him and was reassured that he hadn't turned into a monster, whatever Ben Skywalker might have thought. Different situations required different incentives, and Shevu couldn't be scared into compliance, or he would have been no good at an intelligence-based, dangerous job. He couldn't be cajoled for the same reasons. He had to be treated with honest respect. The man was as straight as a die. There were few like that, and worth the keeping. Caldabe, Mandalore. Jaina dropped out of hyperspace in the X-Wing and hoped that making herself slow and obvious would prevent a misunderstanding about her intentions in a Galactic Alliance fighter.
I must be out of my mind. I should have contacted Fett in advance. But if he'd said no, then I'd still be here, and I'd be in worse trouble. And it's always harder to turn someone away when they show up in person. And Fett respects physical courage, and...
And she was a Jedi entering Mandalorian space. That was all there was to it. But she had to get past the gatekeeper to get to Fett to win him over with her straight talking. And this was no time to lose her nerve.
Caldabe ATC, this is X-Wing Amber 9, requesting permission to enter Mandalorian airspace.
She checked again that every weapons system was powered down so that nothing, absolutely nothing, gave them the wrong impression about her intentions. Maybe a shuttle would have been a better idea, but she had no idea how she might be received, and being cannoned up made her feel better. The X-Wing held its position.
Keldabe, this is Amber 9. Are you receiving me?
Keldabe ATC to 9 Amber, said a female voice that didn't sound remotely ruffled by the intrusion of a GA fighter. Maybe they shot them down every day for practice. It was going to be a hard way to find out.
Pare Sol, wait one.
Would they even recognize her? The X-Wing was obvious enough, but she wasn't a known face like Jason or Mom. She was just a pilot, not even in GA Orange, deliberately low-key in a somber flight suit with her hair tied back. All she needed to do, though, was to land and do the humble thing, to throw herself on the mercy of Boba Fett, and she was still gambling that saving the salient point about her real identity might get her a little farther. If she said right now that she was Jaina Solo, there was no telling if some Mandalorian patriot might fancy settling the family score on behalf of Fett.
If a bunch of Mandalorians had shown up asking for Dad, I know how I'd react.
Jaina had never been in Mandalorian space before. Mom had, in her rebel youth. She said the Mandalorians lived in treehouses, and their leader, a blonde man called Shisa, had been very charming. Jaina waited, cultivating a patience she never knew she had. Her force senses told her something was approaching, but she sensed no danger. It felt oddly benign, in fact. If she hadn't known better, she would have said amused. Yes, there was definitely something approaching her. Nothing showed up on the X-Wing's monitors other than a medium-sized chip with a heavy drive, something like a spaceport tug or some utility vessel. Perhaps it was going to escort her in. It was very close now. Jaina still couldn't see anything, but it was approaching from her port side. It was only when she turned her head as far as she could, unable to sit still any longer, that she saw a black void where stars should have been, and picked out a large, unlit shape heading straight at her. Had it detected her? It was on a collision course. Jaina got ready to run. Then the lights came on. The brilliant blue-white light seared her eyes for a split second, but when she blinked away the afterimage, she was looking at a grim slab of a vessel that was a mass of cannon turrets, turntables, hatches, and angles. There was no other way to describe it. It was a flying tank.
Keldabe welcomes careful Aruetise, if their credit's good, said ATC over the comlink. Nine Amber, what's the purpose of your visit? Here we go. Just do it. I've come to see Boba Fett. Amber 9, identify yourself. Keldabe, I'm not GA anymore. I sound like a criminal.
They might have been detaining her. It was hard to tell.
I've come alone. Follow your escort.
She was still in one piece. That was something, although she would have to work out what Aruetise meant. The tank rotated 90 degrees in the horizontal and pulled away in front of her, dipping its starboard side like a wing to indicate to her to follow. She'd expected to be met and checked over by a Besulik, and was almost disappointed not to encounter the new Mandalorian fighter. They said it was faster than an X-Wing. Corellia and other planetary forces were lining up to buy them.
Aunt Mara would have had fun with one of those.
The memory ambushed Jaina several times a day. She thought it was better than forgetting, however much pain that would have saved her. She had learned that when Anakin died. Before she reached the upper atmosphere of Mandalore, the ungainly-looking tank was joined by a smooth delta-shaped fighter, and Jaina had her wish. It was the Besulik she'd seen on the Holonews channels. The vessel maneuvered between her and the tank, so close that she could see the helmeted pilot turn to give her a hand signal familiar to any pilot. Follow me. The tank peeled off and vanished, showing remarkably little heat signature on Jaina's sensors.
What was that? She asked.
You want to place an advance order? Said a male voice.
It was the Besulik pilot.
Mandel Motors calls it the Trakod, the Star Saber.
It was an elegant name for an inelegant vessel, and Jaina put it on her list of things to worry about much later. Landing on Mandalore needed every scrap of her attention. She was suddenly in busy airspace over heavily wooded country, scattered with small villages. Kaldabe loomed in her viewscreen, a massive, disorganized fortress set on a granite pedestal ringed by a moat-like river. She could identify the Mandel Motors tower from the logo painted on it, that grim animal skull with a flare emerging from one empty eye socket. And her passive scanners were picking up a formidable array of ground-to-air defenses. Kaldabe was ready for all comers. She brought the X-wing down in a smooth descent, tailed by the Besulik. The apron area was packed with vessels from battered gladiators and smart new KDY-armed transports to, and this rattled her composure a little, old X-wings in garish paint schemes. Most vessels were disgorging passengers, all of them wearing that distinctive full-body armor in a riot of colors. Red, deep yellow, and forest green seemed to be very popular. The X-wing's undercarriage shivered as it landed. Jaina was past the point of no return.
"Holiday?"
she asked over the comlink, trying to be casual.
"Return of the expatriates," said the Besulik pilot. "Millions of Mondoade live on other worlds. The Mandalore asked for volunteers to rebuild the planet, so they came. They're getting their land allocations."
"I had no idea you were so scattered."
"That's why you can't get rid of us. It's like trying to hammer mercury. It just breaks up and comes back together again."
Jaina noted that for future anxiety sessions, shut down the systems, and prepped to pop the hatch, wondering if Amber 9 would end up appropriated by the locals and painted bright purple like an old X-wing sitting in a corner of the strip.
"Get down from the cockpit, Aruati, and we'll check you out."
"Now, do I take my lightsaber or not?"
Jaina took the risk and left it in her grab bag in the cockpit. She jumped down and stood on the permacrete, an anonymous gray flight suit in a sea of clattering Mandalorian armor. The air smelled of fresh-sawn resin trees and hot metal.
"Just tell me what Aruati means."
"Foreigner," said the pilot.
He pulled a short-stock Blastech blaster from his belt with a casual movement and ran a hand scanner over her with the other.
"Outsider. Not one of us. Even traitor. Okay, you're clean."
She thought he would have been far from pleased if he'd picked up her lightsaber on that scan.
"What happens to me now?"
"Someone's coming to check you out. Can't let just any old riffraff pester our Mandalore, can we?"
Should she admit who she was now? The man had a blaster. If he took the revelation badly, she'd have a choice of taking whatever came next, or drawing on her force skills unarmed while surrounded by hundreds of Mandalorians, every single one of them with some weapon, even the children. It would all get out of hand before she knew it, and she needed Fett's help badly.
"Absolutely," she said.
Jaina was already having to think differently, to suppress all her own training that said she should have been treating this environment as a serious threat and preparing to defend herself. The feeling of helplessness was both utterly alien and disturbing. The Besulik pilot didn't say anything else to her,
and just stood with his blaster resting in the safety position against his shoulder. They waited. People were starting to stare. Eventually, a speeder bike edged through the crowd on the perimeter and headed straight for her.
"She's all yours," said the pilot. "Unarmed."
The rider was a man in royal blue armor, and she sensed that he was agitated, but in a distracted way that said he was worrying about something else.
"I'm Goron Bevin,"
he said, looking wary. A short but serious-looking metal saber hung from his belt, as well as a blaster.
"The Mandalore is tied up at the moment, so you can tell me all about it. Get on."
It was tempting just to come clean and tell him she was Jaina Solo. Yes, that Jaina Solo. But a black object dangling from his shoulder plate distracted her. It was alien hair, somehow familiar. Mandalorians loved their trophies. Fett went in for braided Wookiee scalps. It was pretty disgusting, but she wasn't here to be judgmental about their customs. She needed Mandalorian help.
"Is that Yuuzhan Vong?"
she asked, trying to be casual.
"Indeed it is," said Bevin. "Nothing I like better than killing crab boys."
That was the sum of their conversation until they reached Keldabe. Mom had been right. There were some treehouses along the way. But the city was just that, a tight urban chaos of granite blocks, wood, plastoid, and durasteel, with the houses packed together like a close-quarters battle. There were still signs of war damage on many walls, and even Mandal Motor's 100-meter tower bore scorch marks. A few new offices and other buildings looked grander, but this didn't appear to be a rich city, or even a planned one. It looked like a battered survivor. Bevin stopped the speeder in front of what could only be a cantina. Its doors parted, and the smell of cooking and brewing wafting onto the street. Above the entrance was lettering Jaina couldn't read, and, helpfully, a few words of basic. "Universe Tap Calf. No strills inside. Barter accepted." Jaina followed Bevin inside. He took off his helmet, laid it on the counter, and ruined another stereotype for her. He wasn't some granite-faced thug, but an ordinary gray-haired man about her mother's age, with the kind of face that looked on the edge of a big smile all the time. And the Fett-inspired image of Mandalore that she'd nursed for so long kept crumbling. When her eyes adjusted to the light, she found herself in a cantina full of armored Mandalorians, not all human, helmets stacked under tables. They were watching a big holovid screen in intent, reverent silence, mesmerized by a bolo ball match.
"Meshgaroya,"
Bevin whispered, as if he was interrupting an act of worship.
"The beautiful game. Our other national pastime."
Something small and furry zipped past Jaina's foot, but she didn't dare look too closely. One of the patrons, a stocky man with white hair and a vine tattoo curling up his neck, glanced at her and guffawed.
"Throw her back," he laughed. "You know it's wrong to catch 'em that small."
Bevin was looking her over suspiciously.
"She's come to see Fett, Kerika."
"We're much cheaper than he is, lady," said the tattooed man. "Who do you want hunted?"
"It's okay."
Jaina winced at how uncomfortably close the joke brushed to reality. She leaned against the bar, wondering why she'd been brought to a cantina and not taken to some government building or even Fett's residence.
"I know where my quarry is."
The place smelled of spice, yeast, and fried food, and most of the patrons were drinking a black ale or small glasses of a clear liquid that almost certainly wasn't water. Her force senses told her they were all much, much more worried about the final score than they were about having a stranger among them. Were they really that relaxed, or did they just think that nobody could touch them here?
"I'm sorry to stare," Bevin said mildly, "but I know you, and I'm trying to think where I've seen your picture. Never mind. It'll come to me." His palm rested on the pommel of that saber. Probably just a comfortable way to stand in full armor, but Jaina couldn't stop herself working out how she'd parry a blow from the thing using only the force.
"But you're not going to tell me until you have to, are you?"
"Fett knows me and my family," she said.
She assumed Fett might recognize her. She thought she'd met him once when she was a kid, but someone had said it might have been an imposter.
"He'll know why I've come."
The bolo ball provided a neutral distraction. She was almost caught up in it, so deafened as the room turned from total silence to explosive yells of "Oh yeah!" when the favored team scored, that the sensation that ran up her spine and made her hair bristle caught her by surprise.
"Impossible. No, that's just not possible."
"What's wrong?" Bevin asked.
He reached across the bar, grabbed a handful of something from a bowl, and munched thoughtfully.
"You think that goal was offside?"
Jaina whipped around, ready to run, and the doors opened. Something was wrong, very wrong. The Force was telling her something that couldn't be true. Two Mandalorians walked in, one in armor with no two plates the same color, and one in green, clearly much older, and walking as if his joints were painful. The older man eased off his helmet and placed it on the counter. Yes, he was old. He looked as if life had drained him dry. His stare cut straight through her, and she found herself staring back, wishing she'd announced herself the moment she landed.
"Hello, Jedi,"
he said, and drew a blaster.